To be formal, this is section number 508, Difficult Women, Successful Public Outreach for Problematic Women's Collections. My name is Jenny Benford. I'm the session chair. I'm also going to be one of the presenters today. Again, thank you so much for making us part of your time here at SAA in Chicago. It is appreciated. I will be speaking to you last, and we have two very interesting speakers who are going to go before me, so they're going to make me feel very intimidated that I have to follow them and all the good things they're going to say. I'd like to introduce them quickly, and I'll say a couple words about myself, and then I'll give the floor over to Kelly Wooten, who's our first speaker. Hopefully, our discussion will engender many, many questions. I'm going to ask you to please save them until all three of us are done, and then you're allowed to put us on the spot as much as time will allow. Our first speaker is Kelly Wooten, and she said she has the longest title in the world. So is everyone comfortable? Kelly Wooten is Research Services and Collection Development Librarian at the Sally Bingham Center for Women's History and Culture in the Rare Book, Manuscript, and Special Collections Library of Duke University. Excellent. No one left. Kelly went to library school at UNC, and that's also where she got her bachelor's degree in women's studies and English literature. Her first job after going to library school was public relations and fundraising with a library, and as you all know, that's what makes the world go around. She volunteered at the Bingham Center during this time and knew that's what she wanted to be when she grew up, and just like Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, her dreams came true. And she's there today and very happy. She is going to talk about the controversial materials within the Bingham Collection and some of the innovative work that the collection does with these materials. We're very happy to have Alex Warner with us. She is a fifth-year student, ABD. I had to ask what that meant, but most of you probably know. All but dissertation, if you're like me and wondering. Alex is studying women and gender history at Rutgers, and she is on her second finished the draft of her second chapter of her dissertation, the working title of which is Where Angels Fear to Tread, Feminism in the Leather Dyke, 1974 to 1990. She is doing her dissertation under the direction of Nancy Hewitt. As soon as we asked her if she could participate, she said yes, and we've been very pleased to have her with us, and we're very excited to hear what she has to say. So she will be going second. I, sorry soul, will be following all of that. My name's Jenny Benford. I'm the university archivist at Carnegie Mellon University in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. I'm here today, though, more so as Black Monday. I'm a founding member of Ladies United for the Preservation of Endangered Cocktails. And yes, all of our members have drink names, which comes in very handy when you're doing public outreach at a bar. We do a lot of work in the Pittsburgh chapter with primary resources, and I want to talk about one particular program we did a year ago in which we were able to use a women's collection that was quite unusual and really didn't have any other options for use in the repository where it was. So that's what I will be doing. If I may, though, I'd like to ask Kelly to come up, and she has a presentation ready that she will be giving you, as I mentioned, about some of the controversial materials within her collection.
So, hi, I'm Kelly Wooten, and I'm here to talk to you today to give you an overview of the Bingham Center and our outreach activities, as well as some more specific examples of the public programs that we do on difficult topics and how we successfully promote some of our less traditional collections. And I hope that this talk will inspire you to think about potential programs at your own archives and libraries, regardless of whether they may stir up controversy. So this is our mission statement, and I put it up here to give you a sense of the breadth of our collecting. My main responsibilities at the Bingham Center are to make our materials available to researchers through reference services online and in our reading room, and also to raise awareness about our collections through outreach. The pink corset book shown here is something I like to use show how we did document women's history and culture from a variety of perspectives. This piece is by Tamar Stone, a New York book artist, and it's made of vintage corsets that are embroidered with text from corset advertisements as well as women's own experiences of wearing corsets. So we use our collection policies to narrow down our focus from the whole of women's history, which obviously no institution could hope to collect. And to give you a sense of our more traditional areas, I've listed them up here. These are our core subject strengths in the traditional areas, and these collections mostly cover 18th century to the present, although there are some earlier materials. And here are some of our less traditional materials. By pushing the margins, I mean areas that are less well documented by archives and historians, or populations whose voices have been marginalized. These areas are hot topics for researchers, and they're popular among undergraduates and scholars applying for our travel research grants. It's these collections that are often the topics for our public programs. They're highlighted in our newsletter and on our website, and used most frequently in our undergraduate instruction. These materials that you might not expect to find in a library are often the most fun to work with and lend themselves well to outreach. You can really capture people's imagination, helping them to imagine new possibilities for research as well as envisioning how their own history could be documented. So these are some of our core outreach activities. Our main goal is to promote primary research using our collections, but many people are never going to set foot in our archives or in our reading room. We also educate about the importance of documenting women's history, as well as providing a context and relevance for our historical materials. Whether you're reading our website or our newsletter, exploring an exhibit in our library, or if you're in the audience at a program, we really want you to get the message that the Mingham Center is a place of vibrant activity. The Bingham Center has a history of putting on unique and creative programming to publicize our collection to potential researchers and the public at large. We really believe that the effort that we put into public programs pays off in the long run, as events around a theme can generate added benefits, such as creating an accompanying exhibit, a bibliography or subject guide to put on your website, and also attract a lot of media attention. And that all depends on how many resources you have to invest in a particular program. This past year, we had several author readings, such as the one pictured here with Lisa Jervis and Andy Zeisler from Bitch Magazine, whose papers that we hold. And they came by on their tour for their book, Bitch Fest. So even with tame author readings, we still have to throw the B word around. And our larger events alternate annually between a dramatic reading and an academic symposium. This past fall, our dramatic reading, Throw Like a Girl, was about women in sport and was accompanied by an exhibit. We enlisted library staff, including the university librarian, and Duke students and faculty to participate as readers of everything from early 19th century admonishments about the dangers of swings to a goalie's rant from Girl Jock Zine. The events that take the most work and planning, of course, are the symposia. Several years ago, the Special Collections Library's leadership had been entertaining the idea of the library hosting an academic symposium because of our belief that the library not only supports Duke's curriculum and academic research, but also informs it through instruction and programming. We really kicked off this series with a bang, tackling the topic of abortion. And 2 years later, approached the topic of generational feminisms, which in some circles is no less controversial. And we're currently in the middle of planning our third symposium, Neither Model Nor Muse, Women in Artistic Expression. All of these events have their own webpage with the full program schedule and other related materials if you're interested in learning more about what we did with these symposia. So why abortion? The timing of the abortion symposium coincided with the 30th anniversary of Roe v. Wade, as well as the 15th anniversary of the Bingham Center. Given the center's commitment to acquiring and providing access to a wide range of materials related to the medical, social, legal, and political history of abortion, the library seemed a natural place to engage in multidisciplinary dialogue regarding abortion and the issues associated with it. Director Laura Mickham also believed that the symposium could help inform the public conversation around the lead-up to legislation on so-called partial birth abortion by offering historical perspective. As it turned out, the symposium was held the same week that the legislation banning partial birth abortion passed, and it was during a time when people were organizing the March for Women's Lives, which was held in April of 2004 in Washington, D.C. So abortion is always a tricky subject to talk about, but this turned out to be a very emotional time for discussing women's reproductive rights. And given this timing, it was essential and difficult to maintain academic integrity and avoid being seen as an advocate of any political position. This meant being challenged by people on both sides of the debate. For example, some pro-choice feminists really took us to task for not signing a statement supporting the March for Women's Lives, but it was not appropriate for a unit of an academic institution to take sides. On the other end of the spectrum, it was difficult to get an audience with the pro-life student groups to invite them to participate because of their assumptions of our position. Eventually, our director, Laura Mickham, was able to attend one of these groups' meetings and persuade some of the students to join a panel with other students representing a range of perspectives. There was another panel featuring two Duke faculty members from opposite sides of the abortion debate, although that panel did not spark the most controversy. And the exhibit on contraception and reproductive rights also did not turn out to be as much of an issue as imagined. There were some negative comments in the comment book that was put out for reactions, but there was no vandalism as feared. The most heated part of the program turned out to be the panel that featured abortion providers from the Feminist Women's Health Center, the National Women's Health Organization, and the Chris Clinic for Women, all of whose records are housed at the Bingham Center. The panel discussion itself generated some heat, and then towards the end of the session during the question and answer period, a graduate student raised her hand to speak out as an anti-choice person who believed that abortion was wrong under any circumstance. This provoked an angry response from one of the panelists, and afterwards the student felt that the Bingham Center was irresponsible for choosing a speaker who would verbally attack a program attendee. But fortunately, one of the advisory group members of the symposium was able to speak to her. And I don't know exactly what he said to her, but the woman was so impressed by the response to her concerns that she later emailed the Bingham Center's director to offer to volunteer. Essentially, this communicated that the care taken by the Bingham Center in meticulous and thoughtful planning to provide a safe environment for discussing a difficult subject was able to diffuse a tense emotional eruption. There was also a plainclothes security officer on hand throughout the day, but ultimately there were no situations requiring intervention. So some of the speakers actually were a little bit disappointed that there weren't any protests or disruption at the event. But overall, the feedback and reactions to the symposium were positive. Attendees, particularly faculty members, really appreciated the opportunity to hear practitioners speak about their work rather than just analyzing the issues in an academic vacuum. The program included people from the sciences, social sciences, and humanities representing a range of viewpoints that perhaps just one academic department could not have offered. The high attendance and the willingness of library staff to volunteer at the registration desk also demonstrated that the Bingham Center was successful in promoting the program as appealing to a wide audience. This budget for the first event was only a few thousand dollars, and the Bingham Center was not able to offer a lot of compensation to speakers. However, many were willing to travel anyway because it was so important for them to have the opportunity to talk about abortion in this setting. Our symposium this year is somewhat scaled back from the previous years in the number of sessions that we're offering, but it's still an ambitious event requiring a large investment of staff time, energy, and budget. So I'm now going to turn from talking about this large-scale event that we hosted to the more day-to-day work that I do promoting one of our less traditional collections. So if you forgive the abrupt transition. So what's a zine? Our zine collection is one of our most popular collections, and zines are little photocopied publications with a do-it-yourself cut-and-paste aesthetic and can be about any topic that you can imagine. I'm just going to do a little poll. Has anyone here ever written a zine? One person? Has anyone ever read a zine? Oh, great. Wonderful. So a majority of the zines that we collect are written by women and girls starting in the early 1990s to the present and coming out of the Riot Girl and Third Wave feminist movements. Our zine collection started in the year 2000 when Sarah Dyer, author of Action Girl Comics and Action Girl Newsletter, and an avid zine collector in New York, contacted the Bingham Center looking for a home for her collection of over 1,000 zines. She is the one who really made the connection between our collections of 19th century women's letters and diaries and the zine writings of 20th century women and girls. In addition to capturing aspects of popular culture and the everyday lives of average white middle-class young women, zines also document more marginalized voices, such as queer people, people of color, women who have experienced sexual assault or live with eating disorders, and fringe subcultures. And that's at the 30-second version of my zine talk, which is a whole nother topic. So some of the difficulties of zines are more on the librarian side of things. For one thing, they're difficult to acquire. Sometimes you need to develop relationships with donors who may be mistrustful of institutions, and some individual zines are cash or trade only. We've been really lucky to have Sarah Dyer's collection because her name carries a lot of weight in the zine community and legitimizes our own collection. And we've also developed relationships with distributors like Parcel Press, where we can purchase zines on certain topics, and he doesn't mind dealing with our bureaucratic payment system. Zines are also difficult to catalog, and most zine libraries end up making up their own databases or systems for dealing with them. And then there's also challenges with privacy rights. We treat these as published materials, even though they're often deeply personal and originally intended for very small audiences. So zines lend themselves really well to most outreach activities due to their diverse contents and visual appeal. I use them in most of the instruction sessions that I teach, and they work really well with older manuscript materials, letters and diaries, with our girls and prescriptive literature collections, and of course they are obvious successors of the self-published periodicals of the women's and LGBT movements in earlier decades. So students' reactions to zines really range from confusion and distaste to titillation to enthusiasm and enjoyment. They don't always know how to read or approach the zines, particularly in a research setting, although I have to say that a lot of the hesitation comes from the handwritten and kind of grubby nature of the zines, which is also challenging with 19th century letters. It's hard to read the handwriting. In one class that I taught, most of the students preferred to choose published books to look at instead of the zines, except for one pair who chose a zine that looked really glossy and produced on the cover, but it turned out to be one of the more pornographic items in the collection. And it's hard to resist the urge to censor and pre-select items for students' use, and it's sometimes necessary when working with younger groups like we have in high school age and younger students. But I have to say, even when you're working with older 19th century prescriptive literature, you don't ever know what you're going to grab. We have an online database, and I clicked randomly on a chapter in some prescriptive literature book expecting maybe some housekeeping, and it was a big anatomy lesson. So anyway, zine collections are also really popular with researchers outside of Duke, and we usually have several travel grant proposals based on using zines, and people from across the country and Canada and beyond are interested. Because we're trying to build our zine collection at the same time as encouraging research, we often end up going places that most librarians wouldn't venture, or at least not with institutional support. We've been to Ladyfest Midwest, Ladyfest South, the Radical Book Fair in Baltimore, the North Carolina Girls Rock and Roll Camp, and Southern Girls Convention, just to name a few. Our new zine website is the latest tool that we've created for outreach. And previously, we only had a web presence in some online media coverage and listings for zine libraries. So the zine website is essentially a subject guide to the collection. And subject guides like these are really valuable outreach tools for us because they're so accessible online for researchers and really open up the collections. Sometimes the most difficult thing of all with outreach is just making our library seem approachable and accessible. For one thing, with the zine website, I tried to take a lot of the typical librarian language about procedures and copyright and who can use the collections and when and why and make it sound a little more natural and less stodgy. We put a lot of work into creating these pages so that researchers can have a high level of access to collections that were hard to locate in the online catalog or difficult to approach without already being in the know about zines. So the last thing I want to show you today is a screenshot from our zine pages, and this is the search interface to the most important part of the zine guide. The search box is really simple. You can pull down and search by keyword, title, author, or subject. And we also provide browsing by region and topic. And before this existed, the only access to the collection was through a mediated search through a librarian with an on-site access database that wasn't available outside of the library, or through title-only listings of some in some finding aids for a couple collections. One of the best things about this new database is that searchers can now find our zines through Google, whether they're looking up their own names or the title of the zines that they wrote. We've had several people contact us about sending us more zines when they've found us this way. And as you can see from some of these topics, it really, if you can read them, there's a lot of racy personal stuff. There's a lot of sexuality, whether it's talking about positive experiences or negative experiences of violence and abuse. There's a lot of, you know, things like drugs, drug culture, and other things that you're just not going to find in a lot of other repositories. And so that's sort of a sense of what we're doing. And on the right, you can see the navigation bar with all the other sections of the subject guide. The site was launched over the summer, and we're really looking forward to seeing how students, or Duke students, are going to use this resource for research, and whether we're also going to attract more researchers from across the country and around the world. So these are things I'd like you to remember from today. And it's that I think that librarians and archivists have a unique opportunity to frame contemporary topics of debate or academic interest with historical context from primary materials. So your archives are as relevant as you make them. Also, faculty, students, scholars, and the general public really appreciate the opportunities to meet and interact with archivists, historians, and creators of the historical record. So you really, you're not just talking to researchers. You really want to open your archives up to anybody you think who might be interested. And also, putting on programs really does take up a lot of resources, both time and money. But the return on your investment can be really high. Generating exhibits and bibliographies, reaching out to potential donors, and creating media interest in your institution, it can all really be worth your while. So I underestimated how many people would be here today, and I only have about 20 copies each of our two most recent newsletters, but they're all on our website, and they're up here if you'd like to take one. And they both have my contact information as well as my card if you have any questions. But if you have any questions now, obviously save them to the end. So, thank you.
All right. Can you see me? I'm short. hi. So this is the official title, was Private Lives and Public History, a Case Study of Writing Leather Dyke History. And then historians like a lot of titles, right? So I give a subtitle, Sustaining Difficult Researchers, How to Support Historians and Others Working with Problematic Women's Collections. As I started thinking about putting together this presentation, I thought about, you know, how often does a historian get to stand in front of a group of archivists and tell you how to make our lives easier? So that's what I really sort of brainstormed around. And so I made yet another title to the project, which is called Letter from a Leather Dyke Historian. I'm also going to take this moment to tell you that there are some images in the slideshow of leather dykes, as there are over here. So, you know, if that's offensive to you, I don't know, close your eyes or go to a happy place, I don't know. I figured there was some kind of implied consent because it said in the description that I was going to talk about leather dykes. So, you know, you can write me an email if you're really offended. I don't think you will be, but whatever. Okay, so in the format of the letter, I have actually done, you know, a format of writing, Dear Archivists, as a historian of one of the most problematic groups of women known to man, and yes, the pun was intended, thank you, I'd like you to consider these points of advice as you move forward in your pursuit of information sharing and knowledge production. And don't worry, I'll go over these 4 points again. Advertise. Be accessible, think money, as in giving it to us, and be supportive. Okay. So, advertise. One of the most important things that I think you can do if you have a difficult collection is to make sure that the people that want to work with your collection or that haven't even thought about working your collection know that it exists. So one of the ways you can do that is you can connect with appropriate graduate programs, whether that's administrators or advisors, and their associated librarians at the major graduate programs that are related to whatever it is you do. And I was thinking about, like, I would come up with some list, and then I was like, you know, I'm going to forget someone, and they're going to be offended. So I just say, you know, you can do it on your own, or maybe someone in the group can, you know, volunteer to do it for everybody. And you could just email those departments and say, you know, we have this collection, or the librarian at that school, and say, you know, we have this collection, because a lot of times, you know, the collection might be a smaller part of a larger, more traditional archive, and people might not know that it's out there. Even, you know, when we start to do our research, it tends to be pretty hard to find some of these things. So one of the things you can do, of course, is to make sure that your collections are advertised clearly on your institutional websites. That may take some finessing with people that don't want to advertise that you have that collection. I don't know. But again, the more information you can get out there just to let us know that these even exist, because particularly people working on difficult collections, a lot of them are some controversial in some way, sexuality, gender, queer studies, a lot of times people really don't even know that there are possible sources for what they're going to do. For example, when I started this whole crazy idea of writing my dissertation on the history of the Leather Dyke community, I had no idea that there were so many resources out there. And I thought, you know, I'm just going to have to do all oral history, which I love, but I had no idea that there were all these sources in all these different places sort of hidden. And obviously I found them, but, you know, there's ways that we can make that process a little bit easier and encourage more people to do, you know, creative projects. Of course, you know, get listed on search engines, Google, Yahoo, whatever. And then network with other non-traditional archives. Have you been to the Leather Archives and Museum? There's their address. There's their phone number. They're in Chicago. And it's an amazing organization. And one of the ways that I've actually found sources is by talking to my difficult collections librarians and archivists. And they said, oh, did you know that this tiny little library in Northampton has this collection? No, I had no idea. Thanks. And, you know, again, because a lot of the stuff isn't listed, a lot of the stuff isn't other places, so the way we find out stuff is through other librarians. All right, so let's advertise. Be accessible. I like my pictures. I think they're kind of funny. I tried to be creative. One thing that you can do is you can identify one person who knows a lot about the collection to be the key contact for that collection. So someone who knows what's in it. So, you know, when I call you from New Jersey and you're in San Francisco, I can know what's in there before I fly out. Not that I don't want to fly to San Francisco or Chicago or New York. But, you know, the more information one person can give me, the easier it is to make me be able to apply for money from other places. You know, when I can say, this is what's in their collection. And I found oftentimes that if there's one person that knows a whole lot about that collection, that can be really, really helpful. Have hours that are dependable. Particularly for graduate students, we don't have a lot of money. So when we travel places, we need a lot of access to wherever we're going. We need to be able to come, you know, for a lot of time in a very short amount of, you know, or for have a lot of time in the archives for a short amount of time. As part of that, and I struggle because, you know, my partner's a librarian and I don't want to tell her to work nights and weekends, but try to offer some non-traditional hours, you know, so like maybe there's some times when people, maybe if people are working or they're in graduate school, you know, if you only have 9 to 5 hours, that's going to be pretty difficult for some people to get there. But there's another way to get around that, which is to be flexible with legitimate researchers. One of the best things that people offered me, and I won't tell them where, just in case it's controversial, is people would sort of let me into the archives when it wasn't open or when they had to go somewhere else, but they knew I was going to be in town, or they would let someone else let me in, and then I could do what I needed. And obviously this was after they met me and they trusted me and they knew I wasn't going to trash anything. And that I was there for a legitimate reason, and I was going to honor the process both of taking care of the actual archives and the information that I got it. So, and there were a number of different archives that offered me that access, and that made my project a whole lot easier to do. please use standard organizational techniques. I think particularly in the women's community, there's this desire to be alternative and, you know, use some sort of feminist analysis of how we're going to categorize things, like use people's first names instead of last names. But when you're trained as a historian and you go to look, you know, for Pat Califia, you look under C for Califia, and, you know, to be under P for Pat is a little bit, like, disorganizing and overwhelming. I mean, not that we can't roll with it, but, you know. And one of the other things is that it also, it lends legitimacy in the world of the academy to treat these collections as if they are serious academic collections, and they are. So, you know, I struggle, the feminist in me versus the, like, I want to know where the information is, you know, whatever. That's my That's my two cents on it. Think money. One of the things you can do is you can develop research projects or grants specifically for your problematic collections. And you can be creative, and this is where I'm going to turn attention to the exhibit over here. The Leather Archives and Museum had an interest in the leather community to have a traveling exhibit on women of leather. And it was something that they had had, and some people had sort of given them some feedback. And they actually contacted me. I had been doing research there. And they actually hired me to put together this exhibit. And this was an amazing experience because it produced something for them that they can use as part of their roadshow. They do a number of different traveling exhibits. So they have this product that they can take out to the community, which is hopefully informative and visually appealing. And at the same time, I got paid to go and do my research for my dissertation. And I needed a lot of time there, and I got to go there for 2 weeks, and I didn't have to put out a whole lot of money to do it. So there's this really creative relationship where I get to do a lot of my research. I get to have this amazing thing that I can say I produced. It's a great line for my CV, right? And the LA&M gets this project that they get to take out and use to publicize what they do and how they support the community. So that's one example of a creative way that you can think money. One of the other ways is you can earmark or prioritize standing research funds, whether you do this formally or sort of informally, for those with specific interests in these collections. So they were saying, Kelly was saying that at Duke they have a number of people that write in looking for access to the zines. Well, maybe you say out of the 15 that we're going to give, every year we give X amount. Or maybe you just kind of, sort of subtly agree to that, even though it's not written in formal policies. You just kind of give money, because one of the things is that it's very difficult for people that are working on alternative research projects to get money. We don't get money from the major funding sources. We don't get $15,000 fellowships from, the Council on Library and Information Resources. We just don't. And that's fine, and it's okay. But one of the ways you can support us is by giving us these tiny little pieces or maybe big chunks that help us over time to be able to do our research and not go into too much credit card debt. One of the other things you can do is you can encourage scholars working on difficult topics to apply for funds. This is a tip that came to me from thinking about my experience at the Schlesinger. I had gone there to look at what they had, and one of the librarians said, you really should apply for our research grant. And I thought, I would never have thought to apply for this at the Schlesinger, right? They're a fabulous archive, but I thought they were going to be conservative and I applied and I got the research grant. And I was able to spend some time there working on the Women Against Pornography and Violence in the Media collection. And so, I'm sorry, the Women Against Pornography collection. My head's all, in my dissertation. So encourage people, especially if you work at, what is considered a more traditional archive, to apply for those funds if you know that they will actually be taken seriously. Consider lowering associated costs, whether that's membership or copying. If your standard copying rate is 50 cents a page, maybe you have one fund for people that can't really afford that much, or maybe you charge people 50 cents a page because you copy it for them and you can let certain people copy it for themselves and it's only 10 cents a page. I mean, these are all tiny little ways that in the end can add up, especially to someone that's working on an alternative research project. Be supportive. And this comes down to, like my pictures, this comes down to, again, keeping in mind that a lot of people that are going to be doing these research projects, we get a lot of flack from a lot of people inside the academy particularly, but sort of maybe from our personal lives, who knows, right? And so one of the things you can do, if you think what we're doing is good, is be supportive of us. You can offer encouragement. We need it. You can connect us with other difficult archives, alternative sources, other people that might be working on topics that are like ours, because as much as you can connect us with each other, that's another way to support us. As is appropriate, you can offer ideas, feedback, and constructive criticism. A lot of us don't have a whole lot of people that know what we're doing, right? Even if they're, scholars in the field of women and gender studies, no one has ever written a history of the leather dyke community, ever. So no one has any idea what I'm doing, which is good because no one can really criticize me too much. But but so if you know something about that, or you know something about a particular collection, or you think, Alex, you're going down this road and I think maybe you want, that's in the right context, really important information, because not a lot of people can give me a whole lot of feedback about that. Now I'm going to get all these emails about what I should do differently. Read our articles, buy our books, and then recommend them to librarians, students, TAs, professors, and other archivists. You know, one of the reasons people don't work with these collections is because there's this idea in the world that we're never going to get, you know, we're never going to get published. Or, as the second one is, we're never going to get jobs. So if you have any pull on that, you know, help us get jobs, help us get hired, because then we, again, we're taken more seriously in the world of the academy, which, of course, I think we, you know, I think it's a very serious, important endeavor. So, you know, here's my thanks. I hope that my experience gives you something to think about, maybe an idea. My email address is there. It's awarner@eden.rutgers.edu. The last part's obviously a joke. I mean, unless you want to send me money, in which case, definitely I'll give you my mailing address. And then these are the photo credits, and just a last plug for the Leather Archives and Museum. They're in Chicago. They're open today until 8 p.m. They're open Saturday and Sunday, 12 to 5. And the exhibit will be here through the end of the session and then a little bit after, so please do take a look at it. I'd love to hear your thoughts and feedback, and thanks for your time.
Ah, from bondage to booze. Again, my name's Jenny Benford, and I am the archivist at Carnegie Mellon University, which has been an extremely supportive institution both for my professional career and for my amateur career with Ladies United for the Preservation of Endangered Cocktails. When the dean of the library tells you to put a group called Ladies United for the Preservation of Endangered Cocktails on your dossier, that's a nice feeling. I do want to talk about a very specific project that LUPEC was able to take on last year that did incorporate a problematic women's collection and primary resources therein. In order to do that, though, I do want to indulge myself and give you a little background on LUPEC and how we came about and who we are and what we're doing. So I'll try to give you the brief version of that history, if I may. This is our most recent publicity photo, and I'm the one holding up the Mrs. sign. This is LUPEC in front of the Mesta Family Mausoleum in the Homewood Cemetery in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. We're holding up the Mrs. sign because even though the mausoleum says George Mesta, we are honoring his wife Pearl, if you know the hostess with the mostess. And we flatter ourselves to think that Pearl might like us because as the hostess with the mostess, Pearl Mesta made a lot of progress in the Washington of her time holding parties. And we kind of do the same thing with women's history in mind. So we like to think Pearl would be on our side. The way LUPEC started was as a joke, and I like to think that that's a good way for any revolution to start. What happened was I'm now 41. I was in my mid-30s, youth, and had just gotten out of library school, as had a number of my friends. And I was bemoaning the fact that as I got older, it was harder to stay in touch with my women friends. And as a feminist, this really bothered me. Community, we should be sticking together. But it just became harder and harder. And as I was complaining, I was saying, well, obviously, we should each have a party once a month and serve cocktails, because if we serve booze, people will show up. And I happened to be complaining to a friend of mine who's actually going to be giving a talk tomorrow. Her name is Amy Rudersdorf. And as much as I'm a type B personality, she's a type A, and she would not get off my back until we had a party. So this is the invitation to the first party. This invitation went out with a mission statement and a list of rules of deportment. And both of these are available at our website if you're curious. Within the rules of deportment, though, it set up how we wanted this to work. Everyone in the group was to have one party a year, so the group could be no smaller than 5 and no larger than 12. So we'd have one party a month. You could choose a women's history theme of any type, but you had to have 3 cocktails that were thematic, and you could not make them up. You had to go into the old recipe books, the older the better, find recipes that no one had made since Prohibition, and make these cocktails and serve them. This is La Blonde Negresse. Some of you may have recipe cards for this. It's posing very provocatively in front of Edith Piaf, who we love. Theoretically, the Blonde Negresse was made in honor of Josephine Baker. It's basically a Brandy Alexander, but with gin instead of brandy. It's an excellent drink, if you're wondering. We have no idea if it actually was made for Josephine Baker, but it's a great excuse to talk about Josephine and her banana dance, which we were more than happy to do. So this first party went very, very well, and everyone really came up with some provocative ideas within the group. Among some of our favorites, we had a voodoo party where we talked about voodoo priestesses and had drinks of New Orleans, including the Sazerac and the Ramos Gin Fizz. We had... this is my Mycenaean snake goddess cake, of which I'm inordinately proud. Thank you. This is from a meeting that I had at my house around Easter of that year. It's in a salute of the triple goddess and the three Marys, and kind of taking a Barbara G. Walker approach of what are the connections between the two. And the drinks for that were the Eve, the Diana, and the Godmother, in case you're wondering. And another example... one of our members, Brandy, you're a fine girl, Alexander, had a party honoring Sirens of the Silver Screen. She found cocktails that were made in honor of different movie stars. So we have Sophia Loren, Mae West, and Marlena Dietrich. Marlena collected emeralds, so the story goes that this drink was made in her honor. It's basically rye whiskey, which is fine with me, with a little bit of curacao to make it green, some bitters, an orange twist, and a lemon twist. And it remains one of the favorites that Lupec has unearthed, and we've used it at a lot of our different events. So do try it out. If you got that recipe card, you lucked out, because that's one of our favorites. Gratuitous photo of one of our members. When we first started, we did have a number of members from the library school, but I don't want you to think it was all archivists and librarians. This is Sharon Spell. She's a performer. She goes by Mama Spell. She's a comedian and a tap dancer and a visual artist. We also have administrative assistants, caterers, restaurant owners, a wide range of women in a wide range of positions, and it's always very fun to see who can bring what from what parts of their lives. As any good party will become well known, word started getting out that we were having good parties and not inviting people. And people were asking to join LUPEC, and we were trying not to be a sorority, but we're trying to be selective, because we took what we were doing pretty seriously, even though it was a lot of fun. And then we had some friends of ours ask if we could host us a fundraising party. These women were owners of Blue Ruin Gallery, which was an erotic art gallery in Pittsburgh, which unfortunately is no longer with us. It was a wonderful space. We served a punch for them at a fundraiser, and apparently they made a lot more money than they thought they would. This brought us to the attention of the Mattress Factory in Pittsburgh, and for any of you who are interested in installation art, you've heard of the Mattress Factory. It's a premier... it's a premier museum in the United States, and it's in Pittsburgh. Thank you. They were very gracious and invited us to serve cocktails at their 25th anniversary, and we were able to find a cocktail from the 30s called the Barbara, and that's the name of the woman who founded that museum. And she was so taken with that, she's invited us back yearly for their big fundraiser called the Garden Party, and she had an artist build us a bar from which we serve, which is very nice. So we did a lot of work with other groups, and then we started thinking, well, maybe we can do our own. Why don't we take some things that we want to do and go out there and do them? And for us, this was really quite heady because we don't even have a tax ID number. We are not a 501c3, though we hope to be one someday. Our main fundraiser is a rummage sale we have every year. So basically, we can do whatever we want. And we decided on two things. We decided that we were going to focus on women that most people have not heard of because, as we put it, God bless Sojourner Truth, but aren't there grants for that? Mm-hmm. And also, since we didn't have to ask permission or apologize to anyone, we were going to focus on women who perhaps were a little too controversial or a little more outside the pale that other people couldn't focus on. We were going to try and bring the same scholarly attention to them, but in the traditional LUPEC celebratory way. So one thing we did was we decided once a year we would commission a local bartender to make a drink in honor of a Pittsburgh woman. First one we did was Evelyn Nesbitt, and she's the girl in the Red Velvet Swing. Now that's a little, she's been heard of by people, but she is kind of a hot button topic, so we decided to do her. So the Red Velvet Swing was a drink that was created in her honor, and the guy who did it for us was so taken by her story, he did a couple more drinks, including the Golden Kimono. The next year we did Doris Mercer, who has a great story you can find on our website, but suffice it to say after four marriages, she was Princess Faris A. Sultana. We gave out free tiaras at her party. That was fun. And our third lady, this is Jenny Wood Ferguson. Any guesses on what she did? She was the first in Allegheny County. First what? Tempting, isn't it? The first licensed mortician. I'm sorry, first licensed female mortician. And there was a call for such because it was inappropriate for men to handle the bodies of women or children. Now, she and Doris Mercer are really where we started using primary resources because these are not ladies where there are secondary resources available. We were able to find out about them through the records of the Homewood Cemetery, which has always been very gracious with letting us work with their records because we do help them out as we can. And also, her funeral home was purchased by Samson Brothers Funeral Home, whose papers are at the Historical Society of Western Pennsylvania. So that's another example of those collections Alex was talking about where her name isn't on it, but it's in there. And someone in the know at the History Center clued us in. Look at the photo we get of her. I wish I could be a mortician if I looked that good. But hers was a wonderful story, and the drink in her honor was called the Elegant Embalmer. And it tasted really good until Dell, the guy who made it, told me he had come up with the recipe because he wanted it to look like embalming fluid. And once I realized that, it didn't taste quite as good. Last year was a very sad year because Pittsburgh lost a lady that was very influential in her own way. But it meant that we got to honor her. We try only to honor women who are not around because we don't know if they'll take offense to having drinks named after them. Oh, yeah. No, anyone here know Norma Jean Wofford's claim to fame? What did Duchess do? Guitar player for Bo Diddley. Thank you. Yes, from the Hill District in Pittsburgh. A reporter once went to her dressing room and asked her how she got into those pants, and she held up a shoehorn. So we had a drink called the Duchess in her honor. So these public events went really well, and we were able to get away with a lot of stuff. We had a butch femme party at a bar that used to be a ladies' bar in Homestead. The drinks we found for that were the silk stockings and the diesel. And we gave out candy cigarettes and candy lipstick. And a very informative pamphlet about ladies' bars at the turn of the, at the 1940s and 50s, which actually one of our members had done extensive research on for her master's thesis. We had an all-witch costume party that ran 3 years in a row, the idea being that we wanted to up the numbers for at least one night. So we were able to get away with quite a lot, and then we got a little too successful. This is not a day job for any of us. It takes a lot of time, and as the years went on, we've been around 6 years, all of a sudden we had kids, we were married, we had real jobs. We had to choose our battles, and we decided to focus on Women's History Month. Women's History Month, we would have one public event a week. Now, that decision coincided with a gentleman named Al Kovacek in Pittsburgh getting the lease to what's called the Skinny Building. The Skinny Building is a three-story building that is 5 feet, 2 inches wide. It is in downtown Pittsburgh. It dates from the late 1800s. We have no idea what it was built for, why it was built that way, but there it is. He got the lease to make it an art gallery, and as far as we know, it's the only art gallery where you have to stand outside to see the artwork. There are 36 windows. They range in size from 3 foot by 5 foot to 6 foot by 6 foot. And he would have every month or so a new exhibit up. We asked if we could have March in 2005 for an exhibit we called Lady Names. There's a wonderful Carnegie Library building in Pittsburgh that has a frieze carved of names of famous men going around. I don't know if you've ever seen these. I've seen them on other buildings too. But it's like 108 names of men who were famous as botanists, astronomers, physicians, musicians, artists, composers. We found 108 names of women who were doing the same things at the same time, printed them out on big sheets of paper, put them in the windows downtown, and we had the Lady Names Project. And that went over very, very well. When Al asked if we would do something the next year, we decided it was time to bring up a project we had tried and failed to work with on several occasions. And because it's a controversial topic, I can't tell you where it's from. But there is a private collection in Pittsburgh that has papers pertaining to a restaurant that was in downtown Pittsburgh called The Wheel. The Wheel restaurant was down the street from the Pittsburgh Burlesque Club, spelled with a K, by the way. And the Pittsburgh Burlesque Club, after the ladies would do their dances, they would go down to The Wheel and get cocktails and omelets. And apparently the guys who ran the place were nice to them, and so they would autograph their publicity photos, give them to the gentleman, who would frame them and put them on the wall. So among the business papers of this restaurant were 30 stripper photos, ranging from the 40s to the early 70s, and there wasn't a thing this repository could do with them because all their money was family-oriented. So there these 30 strippers were, Just a Dream, Fifi the No-No Girl, Penny Sillin, languishing away, waiting for us. We tried to do an exhibit of the photos, but then there was a question of paying. We were going to work with Blue Ruin Gallery, but they had to pay their rent, and we can't do that with a rummage sale. So that fell by the wayside. Then we were thinking of displaying reproductions of them, but some of them were under copyright. And what are you going to do to get the money for the reproductions? And can the archives release them for you to scan? No, they can't. You have to do it professionally. There were all sorts of roadblocks to both the controversial collection, a bunch of yahoos, you know, what have a website. So finally what we decided to do was take the money we'd garnered from our rummage sale and doing some of these events, choose 9 of the photos, it turned out 9 that we felt we could put up without being arrested. Some friends did us some favors, and we were able to do what we called the Naked Lady Project, which is a little bit of a misnomer because none of the ladies were naked. Now, this is not one of the photos, but it gives you an idea of what some of the 30 were like. This is Lily St. Cyr, who was a very popular burlesque queen. This is circa 1955, but this is very similar to a number of the photos that we used. This is an image of one of the photos being hung in the Skinny Building, and as you can see, it is a skinny building. Now, this photo was taken by one of our members who actually was thin enough to walk up the spiral staircase to the second and third floors of the Skinny Building. I, being built for comfort and not for speed, took care of getting the photos scanned. I let the little girls do the hard work. And you will see lovely downtown Pittsburgh out the window. This is another photo that was taken of the project being put up. Please note the window down below, and you will see, I believe those are 2 of our screwdrivers. We have a men's auxiliary called the screwdrivers. And not all of them are men, so I think you see Matt and Becky putting up another of the images. By the way, these images, when you see the 8x10s, you think, these are so tame. People today, they're not going to be offended. Blow them up to 6 foot and roll them out on a table, you have to leave the room. It was like seeing these women on an operating table. It was quite humbling. And here you see Sherry Darlin is the lady with the copper tone tan pose. And I think Pat is the name of the Tarzan girl, but I forget her last name. Please note there's text to go with this, and I think I remember the text, at least if not verbatim, I at least remember it somewhat. The text went along the lines of, meet the ladies of the Pittsburgh Burlesque Theater. Yes, that's burlesque with a K. The Pittsburgh Burlesque Theater was at the corner of Liberty and Dawson. There's a parking lot there now. Ladies, who's going to park on your history? Women's history, save it, don't pave it. There's Phyllis Gale. And that's how skinny the Skinny Building is. Can you see that? The pink that you see are actually plastic tablecloths we bought for $1 a piece. They stapled together very nicely for curtains, which was great because Al backlit the exhibit. So you could see it at night, and it was stunning. So nice. And there it is, full front. Full front. Makes me so happy. This actually got a really nice write-up from, of all people, the architecture writer of our local paper, who said that she felt it was wonderful that the burlesque queens were back in the cultural district because Pittsburgh's cultural district used to be the red light district, but they don't like talking about that. So the ladies were able to take it over again. There were a lot of letters written in by people who remembered the theater, not just men, but women too. I was actually at a fundraising event for another women's memorial, and one of the older ladies there went on to say, "Oh, I remember when the girls were there. They had beautiful bodies." That was worth the price of admission right there. Interestingly, where we got the most flack was from the Roboto website, which in Pittsburgh is a website for, I'm 41, so I can say it, the younger crowd. And a lot of people who were in their 20s were taken aback because they thought LUPEC were feminist. And why were they exploiting these women? And it was an interesting, you know, we wanted to do this to engender discussion. And we decided not to try and control how the discussion went. We just wanted the discussion to happen. So we felt that's perfectly fine. A couple of our members went on and kind of said why we felt we did it. Our main question was, whose histories are saved? And that's really what we wanted people to talk about. So we considered it to be a successful use of a problematic primary resource collection. So please be aware that it's not just researchers who can use your problematic collections. And it may not be researchers who have the availability and the ideas that can get problematic collections out there. I was very happy to be an archivist, but I wasn't an archivist when I was working on this. I was a member of LUPEC. And as a member of LUPEC, I was very pleased to have access to a collection that is so controversial, we couldn't give credit to the people who are the stewards of this collection. As an archivist, I understand that there's no such thing as a free kitten. And when you're making accession decisions, if you have a collection in front of you that's so great and you can't do anything with it, what are you going to do? So I think it's important that when you're making those accession decisions, you take a leap of faith and you think, we may not be able to use it now or 20 years from now, but someday somewhere someone's going to blow this up to 6 feet by 6 feet and hang it in a building in downtown Pittsburgh. Now, if you're wondering about LUPEC, we did start as a joke, but I'm so happy to say that for whatever reason, other people have picked up on this, and I do want you to know we have chapters out there now. LUPEC Denver was our first chapter. LUPEC Philly, a fairly recent addition. LUPEC Boston, which, by the way, is just burning the joint up. They've been doing a lot of really great stuff, especially around Women's History Month. LUPEC Phoenix is our latest addition. And even if you're not in LUPEC, I'd like to let you know the traditional LUPEC toast. So when you are going down to the bar downstairs and you're ordering a Marlena Dietrich or a Madam Can You Walk or a Call the Undertaker, I want you to hold up your glass and think about all these collections and say in a loud, proud voice, up in ya. Thank you very much. I very much want to thank you folks for being an attentive audience and thank our speakers for just being, I guess I can include myself, that's the feminist way, for being great. I will be glad to be the middleman as far as questions go, and since this is being recorded, I'll be repeating your questions in a loud, firm voice. So is there anyone out there that did want to ask us anything? Yes, please.
There was an organization within this organization and democratizing this organization.
Thank you. For the recording, let the record show that that acknowledgement has been made that women archivists drink. Thank you. Were there any other questions, comments? Yes, please.
This is so difficult. How do you work with the... I don't apologize, just for the record. How do you work with the researcher in terms of...
Repeat it, or do you want me to?
If you can.
The question is, how do I work with researchers who are coming to use our more difficult collections? And I like to think that the Bingham Center is very welcoming, and we have a subject guide to reproductive rights on our website, so it's out there, and people can go ahead and look on their own as to what collections we have, the clinic collections, the printed materials. And it's our policy at Duke University in general, and the Bingham Center in particular, to not be judging about what someone's research interests are. We have people that are using our feminist collections to, look up things that are maybe anti-feminist. I had a person who called me who was struggling with her own decision.
Jack, you're...
Sorry.
I have no idea.
Their writings, their archival collections, their photographs.
I'm sorry, I have no idea what's going on. It's like...
Wait, it's... The archive...
So,
the spirits are speaking.
We're sorry. It doesn't matter how much you yell at us.
Anyway, we don't usually have to deal with poltergeists in our collection. Basically, people come to us with all sorts of reasons. I had someone who was dealing with coming to terms with their own experiences with abortion, wanting to use our collections, and I'm not going to say, no, you can't come do that. You can only do, you have to be really excited about your past experience with abortion to come use our collections or something like that. I don't have people
and not cut
apologizing.
Off
And I think the Bingham Center has built its reputation among researchers that communicate with each other through the outreach that we do on our website. All of our collections, we try to make them as accessible as possible. So, I speak to a lot of people on the phone or correspond with them over email, and I'm happy that people are coming to use our collections and happy to help them kind of delve into whatever topic it is. So I hope that answers your question.
Any archivists you've had to work with?
Is this on? Yeah. No, actually, one of the most interesting things is I thought that I was going to get a lot of, people that were looking at me sideways. And one of the most interesting things is actually at almost every archive, somebody that worked at the archive would kind of pull me aside and be like, well, I know about this group. And I'd be like, oh, okay. And, it was clearly from some personal experience, or they knew it's off, my friend was, So there was a lot of that. And I was actually really surprised, because I thought, obviously not like at the leather archives or the GLBT archives in San Francisco, I knew that people would be pretty cool. But some of the other archives, I thought that there was going to be, if not judgment, at least suspicion. But everyone has been extremely supportive, which is one of the reasons that I want more historians to do this, because I think there is this illusion that people are going to, find what we're doing really offensive. And I've actually been very supportive by everyone that I've worked with. It's been a really great experience.
Yes.
But the question is actually for Kelly. And you were talking about work to do on that.
So the question is, what is the faculty reaction to a library hosting an academic symposium? And I think overall, they're very supportive, or at least the people that we interact with that are interested in working with us. Like I said, they are really excited to talk to the creators of the historical record. They're excited to talk to other historians, and... really, the library is one place where you can have true interdisciplinary, cross-departmental programs without worrying about stepping on people's toes, because, we cover the range of subjects, and we really strive to be inclusive, to include people from across campus. So I think overall, it has been really positive, and we've tried to include as many different departments on our advisory group board for each symposium as panelists, and we publicize it across campus. So I think that the people that are interested in being inclusive really appreciate it, and I haven't heard any negative feedback about it.
Yes.
With
the Naked Lady Project, I think it ties in a little bit with what Alex was saying, which is most archivists are excited about the collections they have. And I know as an archivist, I have my little pets that I always trot out for people. You know, oh, what about this one? Why don't you try this sort of thing? But and I think it was the same with the Naked Lady exhibit, the repository that holds that collection. The policy of the larger institution was that of being very family-friendly and very child-oriented. But the institution itself and the archivist who worked there knew that they had collections that can work on several different levels. And while they could not put their name on it because of concerns with the larger institution, they were not under any obligation to not help us. They had to help us. We were researchers. They can't, as Kelly was saying, you can't choose who gets to use your stuff and who doesn't. But the one thing that they did request and we did honor their request was not to connect the name of the institution with the exhibit. And, you know, personally, I think that institution lost out. And I felt bad that I couldn't thank the people who helped us because they really did go the extra mile. We made sure to thank them personally, but we couldn't give them the public thanks that we really would have liked to. So I...
Folks didn't want to know where the stuff came from?
They did, and unfortunately we couldn't be... LUPEC could not be forthright with them. And I had to kind of step out of my archivist role because I'm not the LUPEC archivist. And as much as I felt that knee-jerk reaction to tell them everything they needed to go get the stuff, wasn't my job. So,
for my experience, it was really different with each archive. That, for example, the Leather Archives and Museum, they basically gave me complete access to everything. And so I spent the first 4 days there just literally looking at everything in the archive and pulling out everything that was related to women that I could find. And that's where I found all of the gems that I did find. And at the Lesbian History Archives in Brooklyn, again, you know, because it's very underfunded as an archive, so they have stuff, you know, in closets. I mean, if any of you have ever been there, like in the basement is the tape collection. Well, it's not cataloged, so I just opened the drawers and started looking through stuff, and I actually found in there a tape of this amazing workshop that was given right after the Feminist and the Scholar Conference in 1982, which, you know anything about that moment, was this huge controversy between sort of what came known as the pro-sex and anti-sex feminists. And to find the true story, you can read my dissertation when it's done. but they have this tape of this, of outlaw women, basically women into SM, like that feminists, someone taped it and put it in the Lesbian History Archives, and they had no idea that it was there, you know, and now I have it and I'm going to transcribe it. And so, whereas like at the Schlesinger or the GLBT Historical Society in San Francisco, they're a little more organized, so they said, you know, here's a Women Against Pornography collection, and then just like any researcher, you know, you find your gems when you don't. You're just looking for something else, and they're like, oh my goodness, there it is. So really with each experience it was different, but I think the main sort of theme is having access. Having access, sort of as much unfettered access to the archive as possible, to find the stuff that's really going to be the meat of the project.
That's a good point.
It is a very good point, and I think part of the problem is that it's not a collection of stripper photos. It's part of a collection about a local business, and unfortunately that's the angle that keeps it anchored where it is. I shouldn't speak for the Historical Society of Western Pennsylvania because I no longer work there, but while I was working there, there was an adult theater that closed down in Pittsburgh, and they had all the original posters, and this is back to like the 30s. And I wanted, this is another thing LUPEC tried to do, and we just did not have the money or the clout to get it done, but they had the posters that would go in the doors, and they would, apparently the people who owned the theater would take the posters and cut out pictures and make collages so they could advertise three movies at once, and they'd put glitter on them. And the Warhol Museum in Pittsburgh actually was able to get some of these and display them for an exhibit they did on the 50s. But the History Center was chose not to take those, and they ended up at the State Historical Society. So the State Historical Society has them and has a list of all the different titles. And when I was working with them with LUPEC, trying to see if we could use them in an exhibit that we were trying to get together, they said that they themselves couldn't display them because their repository, their site was right across from an elementary school. So, I mean, it's good to know they're there, and they're in a situation where they can lend them out to places like the Warhol. But you know, it is a good question. You know, if you can't feed the kitten, is there someone else who can? And I think that's something we all have to ask ourselves about some of these collections.
Organization.
Well, thank you for flattering us, and I'm sorry to say the cobbler's children have no shoes. There are a couple of us, myself included, who have closets with boxes, and that's about as far as we've gotten. I can tell you we are not at any risk of losing materials. In fact, you'll notice I handed out over 500 drink cards today, and there's more where that came from. But it's joking aside, it is something we've thought of, and we are keeping track of things and trying to have at least two of each publication we put together, because the propaganda is a big part of what we do, and we feel that it does manage to capture really what we're trying to be about, which is calling ourselves feminist as a celebration and bringing in history as part of that acknowledgement. So that's how we flatter ourselves, and we are trying to keep evidence of that going. We don't feel we're at a point yet where we want to codify our history by making it a permanent part of anywhere, but obviously we're using the acid-free folders. So thank you for asking. Let's see. We've got time for maybe two more questions, and then you'll have a little extra time to run out and get to your next session. So anyone else? Oh, I see two. Yourself?
So the question is about whether we have issues with privacy concerns, and the answer is yes. Like I mentioned before, we have these abortion clinic records, but obviously we can't make any of the medical records available that have identifying information about clients of the clinics. One zine researcher that I worked with this past year raised the question of, you know, is it right at all to have the zine collections of people that are mainly still living and have written these very private things and never expected their materials to be in an archives, and maybe some zine writers only gave their zines to certain individuals they felt, you know, were worthy of reading this private this private expression. So basically, with the we try not to take in materials that are going to be closed forever and ever, because there's no point in having them if no one can use them. We try to redact, like if it's a social security number or an identifying full name or something, if we can make the material available with just some redaction, we do that. And then with the zines, we just have them and people can use them, and we don't limit the use based on privacy for those. Does that answer your question? Or, Linda, do you want to add something?
Point out what we have in the slide.
Oh, right. This is my head of reference. we also have researchers sign a 20th century privacy statement. I'm not sure exactly what all that includes, but it's basically, you know, you're aware that these are private records and not to disclose identifying information about sensitive records. And sometimes we have restrictions placed on some collections that limit, you know, are more explicit about privacy.
I would love to address your question as well. Obviously, working on this topic, Leather Dyke history, almost all of the people that I'm writing about are still alive, many of whom are not out publicly, or those that are have
some serious privacy concerns because in many places, of course, the activities that these people participate in are still against the law. People can have their children taken away from them. They can lose their jobs for being involved in sadomasochism. So obviously, even when I started the project, I really sat down with myself and thought about how am I going to honor this privacy and at the same time preserve this history. And so I did a lot of thinking about how, as a researcher, I was going to approach this. And it's come up a number of different times. For example, at the Schlesinger Library, the Women Against Pornography Archives, I can't use any names. That's one of the agreements that they that the organization made when they gifted the collection, which makes it really difficult in writing a historical story and needing to be able to you know, cite sources. So I've come up with some really great pseudonyms that I've made up and sort of dealt with it that way. For example, another example is at the Lesbian History Archives, there's this whole collection of pictures, and there's amazing pictures. And their policy is that unless they have a specific gift that says you can use these pictures, you can't use them, or you can find out who has the copyright for the picture and ask them. Well, the pictures that I want to use, nobody even knows who gave them to the archive, so who do I ask, you know? And there are these amazing pictures, again, of the Barnard Conference, which is this huge moment, and I can't use them. And then the probably the biggest problem that I had actually was using a collection out of the GLBT Historical Society, which was from the Outcast collection, which is, Samwa was the first women's leather club in the United States, and then it sort of morphed into the Outcasts. And they had, their entire archive was there, and in the archive was all of these personal record, like membership lists, names, phone numbers, addresses. And I was really concerned that this was open to the public, because I mean, I'm, you know, well-intentioned and not gonna use this in a bad way, but someone could come in and search these people down, you know, whatever. And as it turns out, that those records were meant to be, what's the word, restricted. Hi, I'm not an archivist. And so I helped them sort of do, I helped them put all the labels on it and all that stuff. And then 6 months later, I got a letter where someone, I don't know who, accused me of having used that information to contact people, which is totally not true. But it brings up this idea that people are very concerned about their privacy, and it's really important, both as a historian and as archivists, to make sure that we're really clear on what those policies are. But also at the same time, you know, struggling with that idea of like, well, if everything's closed forever, then what good is it? You know, like if I can't use any of these pictures and I can't use any of this information, then how can we write this history? And I think it's important to keep that in mind even when we're, you know, when you all are making decisions about what you're bringing in, you know, maybe trying to encourage people to be as open as they can with their collections, because otherwise, you know, it's great that someone can go in and look at these awesome pictures, but, you know, I'm the only person that's ever going to see them. So I don't know. I hope that answers your question in some way.
Speaking as a university archivist, it's something that we struggle with as far as student organizations, because there are a lot of student organizations, not only for issues of sexuality, but issues of politics, where people really don't want their names used, or there's an idea that, you know, youthful discretions will follow them into the future. And yes, you do have to be, you have to be protective of that privacy and respectful. But it's hard enough to get student records because students tend to take their things with them. It's not like faculty who tend to leave everything right where it lay. And I, as a university archivist, I try to go out of my way to foster and support student records of student groups and individual students coming into the archive. And as Alex said, I always try to respect the privacy, especially that which is legally mandated, but also to try and bring things in that people can use. It's a very difficult thing to do, and I don't know about other university collections, but I do find it difficult to make sure that the student voice is represented within the archive. It's a lot easier to keep the administrative voice going, but the student voice itself is a very delicate one, and it's hard to maintain. And in some ways, making restrictions available is one way to foster that, but the question becomes, at what cost? And my hope is that as time goes on, things that were considered controversial are going to become more and more acceptable, and that will ease the problem. But it's the type of cutting-edge research that Alex is doing and that Kelly's collections foster that make it academic and acceptable. It's you have to figure out what risks you're able to take. Yes?
I just wanted to say thank you for injecting some humor and lightheartedness into archives. And not only can archivists drink, they also can be funny.
I think I speak for all of us when we say, aw, shucks. Folks, I promise to let you go, and I will do that again. Thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.